Accession number 20473, Reel 2.
Then done, Reel 2.
Right. Another little instance which you said humorous. It happened when we got off the ferry in the Arman in Douglas. We had to go to Onchan. Now, I don't know if you know Douglas in the Arman. It's got a very wide bay, and the one road goes right along. Then it climbs up to the cliffs, and it's up there where this camp was. It was only a small camp. Anyway, we got in. As I say, it had been snowing over in the Isle of Man. I think it was the first snow they'd had for about 30 years in the Isle of Man at that time. It was pretty heavy snow. And we got in the bus, and we're running up. Was alongside the narrow road there, by the way, there was a tram used to go up and goes right over the top, like a train tram situation. It even runs today, actually, that vehicle. Anyway, we were going climbing up, and suddenly, it must have been about 4 o'clock time. It was just starting to get a bit dark at that time. It'll be about that time. And suddenly the bus we were in, or battered our bus, stopped. And we looked through the windows, a bit dirty, looked through the windows. Couldn't see anything. It seemed odd. Just looked into nothing. Very funny business. So we had to get out. And when we got out, behind us, there was a field with gorse. I just remember the gorse behind us. And when you looked across, there's this little road. There was just a little grass verge and nothing. Any funny place, isn't it? I've always been a great reader. And it reminded me of the talk of Jamaica Inn, when I talk about the road down in Cornwall and the misty day, and you know, and suddenly coming across this inn. And this sprung to my mind. And suddenly we were all standing there, and wondering what the hell's going on. And this petty also didn't know what to do. And suddenly a head appeared. Just above the horizon. Actually, it was a cliff edge. And he said, again, then a big chief petty officer suddenly appeared on the road. Very odd feeling, you know. And come over here, come on, follow me. And we went across, and of course there was steps leading down. The Howstrake Camp, they called it. And it was halfway down a cliff. Like a huge ledge, if you like. It drops down and it goes out. Then it goes down to the sea. I don't know, it's alongside Grudel Glen. Do you know Douglas, by any chance? It's a beauty place, it's right alongside that. Anyway, we went down here, and by God, it was cold too. The wind coming off the sea, and there's no bits at all. This camp was made up of chalets, summer chalets. Now, it wasn't very big, actually. It was a pretty small place, actually. It had a prayer ground of sorts. It wasn't a prayer ground originally, but it had been turned into a prayer ground. And it had these chalets. Now, what I didn't know was that the people, the boys in training in UK at that time, they were taking over the establishments for the, what turned out, MTB bases, things like that, Harwich. And so the Caledonia and all the St. Vincent, all the camps were shutting down for boys, and they were all going to come to the Isle of Man. Well, the forerunners were in the Isle of Man then. Mainly, the few that was in our camp were instructor boys. They'd been probably petty officer boys, and they were turned into instructor boys to get the place organised. And we'd done our 6 weeks kitting up, and getting our kits up to scratch, sewing our names in. One of the things, I think because I'd roughed it in real life, it didn't bother me over much, but a lot of the young lads really broke their hearts, and, you know, a lot of them wanted to get out, and it was sick. As a matter of fact, we had a number of youngsters in that crowd from Southern Ireland, and I don't know any of them that come back after the Christmas leave, because they had to go on leave in civvies. They never come back anymore. Still, mind you, they probably signed up before the war started, and now the war was on, it was a different ball game, because the Southern Irish weren't very popular. In fact, they were virtually our enemies during the war. People don't know that either, but they were. So whether they were got at when I got home. I don't know, but they never come back. But that's just something that happened there. We done our training there. We would normally have gone, after 6 weeks or so, we would have gone into the camps at Douglas, where the main camp was. But because we were having Christmas leave, we didn't go till January, by which time some more boys had joined, and we all went over together down to into Douglas and started our course. It was interesting that year, because that was the year of Dunkirk and all that went with it. Well, they put the 5B people, you know, the 5B people, aliens in the country, Germans and Italians and that, they took them under lock and key. They called them 5B, and they put them in the Isle of Man. Now, the Isle of Man is a typical seaside place with tall buildings in the front for bed and breakfast places, you know, these commercial hotels and all the way around. And they took them over, and they put barbed wire around them. But there was no army in the Isle of Man. In fact, I don't think there was no Air Force either then, I don't think. There might have been somebody at Peel. They did have aerobrome there. But they had Metropolitan Police come over with them to look after them to start with. Now, part of our job was, if there was any trouble, we had to go and sort it out, although we were boys.
Was there any trouble?
Well, we had one or two scares when they bombed Liverpool. But there was one or two reports of a possible landing in Ireland, and the possibility of the Germans going being let into Southern Ireland. And come. I think this was a threat at the time. I don't think it was taken very serious in back home, but from the Isle of Man's point of view, it was pretty isolated between the two places. But anyway, no, we went out once or twice when there was a raids on Liverpool and went and stood guard round the place. But what we had to do, though, was to... the Home Guard was forming up then, if it had formed up, actually, and we had to do quite a lot of... things with the exercises with the Home Guard. And so we had to not only do the naval training as such, you know, seamanship and gunnery and all that goes with it, we also had to do a fair amount of the army bash, if you like, because we had rifles and blunt bayonets and what have you. And we used to go, they used to take us by truck up to Snaefell, which is the highest point there, drop us off. We used to have to come down and have to take over the waterworks and all the different places. And the Home Guard used to be chasing us around. We used to do that. And we had quite an interesting year. And I don't know whether this is something else that you probably don't know, or a lot of people don't know, is that after Dunkirk, they sent a lot of the army people over there to recuperate. Put them in the Isle of Man, recuperate. So we did exercises with them. And of course, they were also guarding the aerodrome over there. The RAF had got sorted out in Peel and Jerby, I think, Jerby aerodrome. So at the time, we'd done exercises with them and had to take the aerodrome with the army defender and all that. So we did have quite an interesting training session.
What condition were the Dunkirk survivors in?
What's it what?
What condition were the Dunkirk survivors in?
Well, they seemed all right. They seemed... We didn't get mixed... You know, being boys, we were very restricted for leave and everything else. So the only time we met them, probably, when they exercised... They were based in the middle of the Isle of Man somewhere. I don't even know where they were based, really. They weren't in Douglas. But we used to... So I can't really say. I don't think these people were all the badly injured, wounded, anything like that. I think people who'd probably... needed the rest anyway, let's put it that way. It's difficult to tell really how people feel after that kind of thing. But as I say, we used to do exercises with them there. But boys training, you know, we used to have a cold shower every morning, not a hot shower, a cold shower. Every morning, you used to have to get up, first thing you do, got up and get your towel and dash down to where you had a big shower room, something about. Oh, the size of all this kind of thing. A bit bigger than this. And a shower heads, probably 30 or 40 shower heads, and they switched them on. And you only had a small door to get through. When you were in there, you couldn't get out because it was packed with lads. We used to have to do this every morning. And our petty officer, we had He had two petty officers when you in training. He had one for gunnery, and the other one was a seamanship man. Our seamanship man was a petty officer who'd come off the Royal Oak. He was a survivor of the Royal Oak, and it was in Scapa. And he was sent more or less to give him a break because he'd had a rough time of it. And the other petty officer was a retired man who'd been brought back in, called him Jack Frost. Of all, he had the right name, Jack Frost, too. And he was a right so-and-so. He was proper Whale Island GI, as we call him, like the Army call him. Sergeant Majors, you know, what have you. But Whale Island GIs are the people in the Navy who are the rough characters. And me and him crossed swords immediately. Oh, dear. He made my life, well, he didn't really make my life a misery, because I enjoyed baiting him to a certain extent. It was part of my life. You had a lot of restrictions as a boy. You weren't allowed to have more than half a crown at any time. You had to send so much money home. You had to write home. And your mail was censored. Postal orders were confiscated and you were given half a crown. Now, I found out very early, far from getting half a crown home and money from home, that was the last thing that happened to me. I was sending money home. It was the other way around with me. So I did decide I had to make money somehow. Life would have been pretty bad altogether without making a few bob extra. So I had a chap in the room with me, a bloke called Dalton, and he come from Nottingham High School. He was a Nottingham lad, Beeston actually, and a bit of an Herbert actually. And so we decided Herbert, a bit of a character he was. In fact, a very very peculiar character really. We decided we were going to supply what people wanted. Well, you weren't allowed to smoke as a boy. You weren't allowed to smoke. But a lot of the boys did smoke before they come in, because they weren't all 15, some were 16. Anything up to 17 might come in. So consequently, we decided if we got fags and we sold them, we could make a few bob. Mind you, you stuck your neck out because you had to break out of the camp to get cigarettes. Now, most of the local shops wouldn't sell you cigarettes anyway. They'd been warned off. There was one shop, was an exception. So I spent a lot of my time and spare hours and that buying and selling cigarettes. So you could sell a cigarette. You get a cigarette and a match. You sell for 2p, tuppence. A packet of cigarettes cost 1 and 6, 20. So you got 20, you get 40 pence back on your haul. Mind you, when you started off, you used to have to climb the wall and it had barbed wire over to get out and get cigarettes and get back again. It was quite a thing. But later on, we found various means and ways of doing it. Like, for instance, we used to march to school. The school was the other side of Douglas from where we were. Called it Ballacameen. Ballacameen is still there, the school. It was just half built, actually, when we took it over. We used to march with it by a drum. A drum at the front, and we used to march to school every day. So you used to have an officer, a few petty officers. In them days, by the way, you were in fours, not threes. You know that? They were in fours. But you could disappear out of a four and not be noticed if you went from the middle. So what we used to do was take turns each. One, disappear. We'd slide out while they were marching, pick up some cigarettes, maybe 40 or 60, you know, about all you could put in your waistband without being too obvious, and then cut across a park and get back in again before without being spotted. And that was, I think we had more fags that way than any other. Another thing we used to do was we had playing fields. The back of the camp, by the way, the camp was part of the TT race start. It was part of the camp. It was playing fields at the back. So what you had there, you had the camp, the bottom camp, and then it was just above the road that was on the sea. Then you had a road in between, the road that leads out to Douglas and goes to Peel and Jervey and all those places, ran right through the camp if you like, but we had a tunnel that went underneath the road, and it was upper camp as well. Peculiar place, really. And down the tunnel was the quarter deck. It opened out halfway, and they had a, well, it'd been an holiday camp, so obviously they had a big fountain in the middle, and they had these little offices around. I presume they were administration when it was an holiday camp, and of course the commander's office and everything was there, you see. Then they had the little part of the tunnel went up to the upper camp. Now, above the upper camp was the playing fields. Well, there used to be patrols all the way around all the time. We used to call them the Gestapo. Used to march around and stop anybody breaking out of the playing fields, because you had the normal hedges that you could get through. So we used to go out of there, sneak out there and buy fags. There was only one shop that sell them, and they refused not to sell. They refused point blank. They couldn't make them. But most of the other shops you couldn't buy from there. But that once, I'd always sell you cigarettes. And two or three times I've been in there, and the patrol stopped outside while I come in to have a look and hit me in the back. It's been an interesting life. But it always meant one thing, that we had money. And my petty officer, he didn't like me one little bit. And he thought I smoked. As a matter of fact, I didn't smoke. I sold fags, but I didn't smoke. I never had smoked. Anyway, he used to say, open your, he used to have belts, you know, blue belts with a pocket on. Let's have a look, see how much money you got. And I had the same half a crown for months. Exactly the same money. That's the same one as you had last time. I said, of course it's not. What do you fancy? What do you fancy? I've got to buy me bits and pieces. It looks the same to me. He was a bit thick anyway. But it was the same one. I'd done it deliberately, actually, to bait him. I used to wear I had a body belt, cloth body belt, and I had notes in there. But I had an interest in boys' training. In
Why didn't the PO like you?
Pardon?
Why did not the PO like you?
Well, one of the reasons was, I think the main reason was, I always look people in the eyes when I'm talking to them, and they don't like this. I've found this a lot in the Navy. If you look at the officers in the eyes and when they talk to you, they don't like it one little bit. They like to put your eyes down. I think that's what started off when he was bawling me out when I first came in. See, the first thing he said to me when we fell in, go and have a shave, see? So I said, well, I don't shave. I was only 15. You bloody shave now, he says. So I said, well, I haven't got any shaving gear. He said, you'll soon get some. And that was it. So the first one he ever spoke to was me, because I had a bit of bum fluff on me first. But there was lots of reason why. But another reason was this. I've always been, in a way, although I don't mind discipline, I think it's necessary, and I never really bucked up against it. But at the same time, if I've thought a thing, I'd say it. I am a bit, what they say, a typical North Country man. If I think I say it. Very often I shouldn't, but I do. I can't help it. I've always been like that. And when you join, you do schooling, and to start with, you also do religious instruction, RI. Well, what the first thing they try to do in the Navy, because it's a fairly religious organisations, get you confirmed if you're not confirmed. Well, we had this religious instruction, and I'd went to chapel or church every Sunday of my life until I was 14. Then my mum said, right, it's up to you now, and I stopped going. So it wasn't that I don't know much about religion, because I do, but I didn't like the pressure that was being put on to get you confirmed. I hadn't thought too much about it. In fact, I hadn't thought about it at all until he comes up with this business of catechism classes and one thing and another. So, all right. I think this Bible basher was... I think he tried to be popular. As he said, I don't want you people just to get confirmed because I say so. That was his attitude. He said, but I'll give you all a piece of paper and you can write on yes or no. Why or why not? So I put no. See? And anyway, I wasn't the only one. I think most people in the class put no. Anyway, he said, the people who put no, he said, I'd like to interview you, talk to you. Well, they took us in alphabetical order, and my name as it is, I was one of the early ones that went in. And he had a nice little office, books all the way around the shelves, and what have you. And started off like a grandfather, like, you know, and one thing and that. And the more he said, the more I was convinced I wasn't going to get confirmed. Don't ask me. It was just something. I think the whole idea, to me, seemed to be forced. And I was determined then I wasn't going to get confirmed. And the top and the bottom of it was, at the end, I got fed up of listening to him because he kept saying, "Did your mother want you to get from? Does God want you to get from?" And so on and so on. Said about arguments. And I looked at the books. He said, "Are you interested in these books?" I said, "Yeah, I am, as a matter of fact, because I've always been a big reader." And I'd noticed one or two of them. I said, "Well, you should come to catechism classes and you can borrow them." I said, "You're trying to bribe me." Without thinking, well, they put me on a charge. So I was in a charge in my very early days, but I'm a padre of all people. And then, of course, after that, life got a bit tough, because once you've been in that kind of situation, and I didn't get made boy first class after 6 weeks, same as everybody else. Through the padre, put a bad report in about me. Anyway, the top and bottom of it was, that was rather funny as well, a bit of a laugh really, because I was told to report alongside on a quarter deck, which is down this tunnel, every Saturday morning. Now, Saturday morning used to have platoon drill and things like that while they'd done rounds, you know, it's a big, always captain's round Saturday morning. I used to go down, stand there outside, alongside this this area in the middle of the so-called quarter deck. It was all tiled and all that, and just stand there, and nothing happened. Well, I must have done it for about four or five times. As soon as dinner was, the bugle went for dinner, I said, "Go back again." That was the end of the story. Nothing happened. Then the last time I was standing there, about halfway through the morning, I could hear feet marching down, and a class come marching down, a lot of chaps come marching down with a Marine sergeant in charge. Brought me to a halt alongside of me, into line left turn. You, he says. I don't know if I was told. I come to attention. They're all alongside of me, I say. "Right," he said, "I'll get the commander shortly, but in the meantime," he said, "you know what it's all about, and behave yourself, I'll go and get the commander," you see. And the commander come out and brought everybody to attention. And right, the commander was on about how important it was to be a bugler and one thing and another. That's interesting. Anyway, he says, "Right, you are." I said, "Well, they're all boy buglers, you see." So when the commander went, the sergeant come around and detailed them off, what watches they had, buglers. And I was the only one left. He said, "Well, I can't find you on my list." I said, "No, I'm not part of your list." "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I'm not part of your crowd. I was here before you were. You told me to get into line." I said, "I did." "God, mate," he said, "you've been made boy bugler." He said, "You can't play a bugle, can you?" I said, "No, can I help?" So he had to get the commander out to disrupt me. So I was a bugler for about 5 minutes. Well, when the commander said, "What the hell are you doing here anyway?" He didn't know anything about me being there. Some idiot, you know, all the way. So I told him. "Oh, but look," he said, "see your petty officer, I'm making you boy first class to get you out the bloody road." He said, "I've seen you standing here." He said, "I don't know what you were doing there," he said, "but get out of it, you know." But this is one of the funny things that happened to me, you know, life. But we left the Isle of Man. We should have been due to leave around about the back end of November, but things had altered. We went the first class to leave the Isle of Man, I suppose. Yeah, there would have been a GC course in between. The routine for boys leaving establishments before the war was that they usually were detailed off a ship. So when they left boys' train, they went straight to a ship, which had a training thing on. Didn't go into barracks. But being wartime, things had to alter. They couldn't very well send us on ships just like that, because ships are spread all around the world. I mean, things are entirely different. So when we left the Isle of Man, we had our second Christmas leave there. In January, we come down together and we parted, because someone were going to Portsmouth, some to Devonport. I was going down to Chatham. When we got to Chatham, they didn't know what to do with us. They didn't have any facility for boys, because boys had to be kept separate from everybody else, you know, to start with, for obvious reasons. They were a bit overprotective in that respect. But anyway, they found a spare block to push us into, well away from everybody else. Actually, that this block was used for new entries coming in. People are coming in the first day and still in civvies and that, and we had to help them to get their hammocks up and things like that. Well, they decided what to do with us. Well, we were there for about, well, probably less than a week, not very long. And then suddenly they sent us to Borstal Institute. That's in Borstal, in Kent. when we come up with a lorry on this, no, sorry, it wasn't a lorry, it was one of these buses with dirty windows, you know, what you can hardly see through. Christ, this is a jail here, portcullis a lot, you know, what the hell are they doing with us? I thought we were going to the DQs or something. Anyway, we drove in, and they were using it for, they're taking all the Borstal boys out, by the way. They were in the farm next door, because they had a farm attached. So they took the Borstal boys out, and they put us in instead. But they were using the place for people coming in, like blacksmiths, miscellaneous people, blacksmiths, artisans of all sorts, to do their initial training. It was about like 6 weeks they did. Kit up, bit of squad drill, and then aboard ships, you know. But we were there to look after them as boys until we got drafts to various ships. That's what that was all about. It was like a marking down place. So we were laying out the meals for them and cutting the butter up and all that lot and the slices of bread and all that. These people come from Civvy Street. They hadn't got the first idea, you know, to do these kind of things. And we'd done a bit of this in the Isle of Man workshop and that. So we looked after them, emptied the dust bins, you name it, everything was needed, done the patrols, done the sentry goes, and even manned the machine guns on the roof, because we were getting air attacks in Kent then. You know, there were fighters with machine gun and that.
This is 1940?
In 1940. January 41. I'd been in Isle of Man a year then, January 41. Anyway, the first draft had come up, all my mates went. Well, there wasn't many of us out of the class. There'd be about, 40 people in the class. And by the time they split up into three depots, it was probably no more than 16 or 17 of us, maybe a bit less, I'm quite sure, in that, from our actual class. There were other boys from other establishments come in of other class. Anyway, the first draft to come up was Gloucester, HMS Gloucester. And I was drafted onto there. I got my draft leave and I went home. I was given a form for my mother to sign. An old boy in the Navy could go to sea under 17 without parents' permission. Did you know that? That's how it was. It was wartime, don't forget. Anyway, I took the form home, went on my draft leave, and my mother said, yeah, all right, I'll sign that. My mother again. She wasn't going to sign anything to start with, you know. She was like that. Anyway, when I left to go back again, I got back and ready to go on draft, and I come, sorry, you can't go. Why? Your mother hasn't sent the form. Oh. So they went. I'm not sure how they went and got on. The Gloucester was in the Mediterranean, by the way. Whether they flew down to Jib or what. Anyway, they went. And I was left without going. But I got in touch with my mum, and she sent the form down. She saved my life. Gloucester was wiped out, and all my mates in there, all the boys were killed on the Gloucester. And my best mate, you know, all the lads I knew went with that. And I was stuck, I was there with the other boys as they come in from various classes come in. And I was then drafted to the Euralis, being built in Chatham. HMS Euralis, Dara class cruiser. She was about the only ship that was built, or biggest ship that was built during the war in Chatham. Didn't know very big. The biggest ship, I think, to be built there at any time was a Kent, I think, a county class cruiser before the war. But anyway, we were drafted on down there onto the ship as working parties before she commissioned the boys. We had a mess deck, and while the dockyard mates were still busy, in fact, they were still spraying all the asbestos on the bulkheads. We were sitting there, but we had this little mess deck, and we done work ship before the commission. And I stayed on it. We went up the Scapa Flow to start with. There's another interesting thing. Have you heard anything about Scapa Flow, Flotter?
Tell me about it.
Well, most of the ships during the war went up there to do the trials, degaussing and torpedo trials and gunnery trials, anything to do with getting a ship Well, it's a brand new ship. And while we were up there, the only thing that wasn't scupper floor from, I think some of the destroyers could get ashore in Kirkwall, places like that, but the main ships,